shining through CIDP to me means being able to do what you want to do and not what the disease is telling you you can't do. Don't give in to the disease. It's not easy, but I'm going to do it. And like I've told people, I may have CIDP, but CIDP don't have me.
Sign up at shiningthroughcidp.com to get real CIDP stories and resources.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Whether thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no hollow, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul, whatever thou be until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles. I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan. I'm Lindsay.
Hello, Lindsay.
Hello, Dan.
Hope our American listeners have had a good Thanksgiving.
Turkey, turkey.
And speaking of giving, I know you have kind of a non-update, but just to mention the Giving Tree.
I have a non-update on the Giving Tree because we record in advance. Today is actually like the day that I'm going to begin all of the sorting of the things out, and we'll be drawing the names from the hats. So, unfortunately, the update is like, we're still working on it. Next week, we'll have an update on how much money was donated from the fans,
yes,
how much money we donated, a probable amount that's coming from Patreon, and how many families we were able to help.
That's awesome.
Yeah, very, very exciting to work on that. Mm-hmm. We hired my mom to help, and we call her Saint Joan. She's literally the best person alive, so super fun to have her on board helping with that.
Yeah, she'll be helping with some extra charitable stuff going forward, too, that you'll be announcing next year.
Yeah, we'll have a big charitable announcement at the beginning of 2022, which sounds crazy. 22.
I know, almost here.
My age. Can you believe it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm 25.
God, it feels good to be young.
Final reminder that the Bad Magic Productions Charity of the Month continues to be IAVA, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thank you again to the Creeps Peepers, other bad magicians who helped us give $15,800 to this great charity that offers guidance, support, and resources for post-9/11 veterans, that community. They do things like assist veterans with using their GI Bill, helping them find housing, mental health support, and so much more. And you can go to IAVA.org for more information.
Sounds good to me.
And how many stories do you have today?
I have two.
You have two. I have two.
Oh, all right. Two, two, two.
Our traditional pair of stories.
A pair of stories, yes. I think last week I only had one, right? If I'm remembering correctly.
That's right.
Because it's confusing because we recorded last week's and the bonus episode.
Yeah.
So
I think you're right. I think you had one.
Yeah. I think I just had one. So yeah, I have a good old-fashioned haunted house. And, oh yes, I forgot how much I love this second story. Also a haunted house, but also a very creepy clown situation.
Oh, we haven't had too many of those.
I know, and I know how much you love a clown.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, I've thought about it so much and joked around about it so much. Like, part of me is like, now I don't think I'm really like bothered by them anymore.
Well, you will be after this.
I know,
this.
But that's what I was going to say. It's like, but if the right situation were to happen, like, if I got to pick which kind of monster appeared in a closet, clown would not be high on the list. Or clowns would not be high on the list.
Uh-huh. What would be high on the list?
I mean, I don't know. Like, if you had to have a monster appear in the closet, I mean, like a vague shadow person sucks, but that would be better for me than, like, a doppelganger.
Oh,
or a clown. Okay. Or like the Hat Man, you know, like with like red eyes. There are some that are scarier than others to me.
Okay. I think something that, I don't know, it's really tricky because if it's something that is like you can't really discern its shape and what it is, I think that might make me more crazy because I'm like, did I see it? Was it something?
Yeah.
Like, it would send me in a spiral as opposed to like, it was definitely this.
Right, right.
Both terrifying.
Both terrifying, yeah.
But at least then you have a definitive answer. Yes, it was a clown. As opposed to, I don't know. I don't like the unknown.
You don't like the unknown? So that one that might be scarier for you.
Yeah. Okay, anyways.
My two stories. My first one is an odd true crime mystery from Finland.
Ooh, okay, fun.
The Lake Boda murders. Four teens attacked at a campsite outside of Helsinki in 1960 on the shores of Lake Bodum. One barely survives. Who the killer is remains a mystery. Whoever posted today's encounter story seems to believe the murders are related to the occult. The second story is a tale of a long haunted address in London, 50 Berkeley Square. So many strange deaths in this home. A few of the people seem to have been literally scared to death.
Oh, okay.
So always very interesting. Are you ready for story number one?
Yes, I have two things to say. Mm. I have a very itchy tag in my sweater.
Okay.
It's driving me crazy. And check out these socks.
Got little dinosaurs on there?
Not just dinosaurs, Christmas dinos. We are full on. You think I'd know how to do this by now.
You have quite a sock collection now.
I know. I have a giant bin of them. I try not to wear them twice, which feels really wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should like donate them.
After you wear them?
Socks? I know. of all the things that I'll give to like Goodwill or Idaho Youth Ranch or whatever, socks, bras, and underwear and bathing suits I'm usually out on because it feels too intimate.
Maybe you should sell all of that on a fetish site and then take the money and give that to charity.
Okay.
You could have just some pervs out there wearing your socks and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe not even on their feet.
Okay, listen, if there's a fan out there that wants to I'll send you all the socks and you can find the pervs. I don't want to know.
Okay. You could have like a perv intermediary.
Exactly.
Somebody who is not part of but knows the perv market well.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
They used to be one. They're recovered.
A recovered perv who's like, I still got a lot of perv contacts.
Yeah, it's like being a recovered addict.
Still got a lot of kink contacts.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay.
The show is so weird.
Well, you get settled in. I will start setting up this tale.
Okay.
It was supposed to be a pleasant lakeside camping trip. Four teenagers set out on a sweetheart's getaway with the intent of roughing it in a single tent perched on the banks of a serene lake. And then at some point in the middle of the night, tragedy struck. By the next morning, three of the members of the group would be dead and the fourth brutally injured. The remaining living member would also become a suspect in a case that many in Finland do not think has a completely natural explanation. Time now for the tale of the mysteries of Lake Bodum. On June 4th, 1960, 15-year-olds Mela Björklund and Anja Maki of Espoo, Finland, set out on what would be a tremendously ill-fated camping trip. Accompanying the two young women were their 18-year-old boyfriends, Seppo Boisman and Niels Gustafsson. They had chosen a well-known campsite on the shores of Lake Bodum. Lake Bodum sits just outside the Finnish capital of Helsinki. Measuring 3 kilometers in length and 1 kilometer in width, roughly 1.15 square miles, the lake is known for its tranquil beauty. It's a big, calm, clear lake with a seemingly endless sky above it. But what would happen on the night of June 4th would be anything but calm. The four teenagers arrived at the campsite around midday and spent a sunny, warm afternoon out in nature. And then that night, after they'd all laid down for bed, something horrible happened. Someone or something viciously attacked the campers. The murderous carnage was all over by the time the sun rose on Lake Bodum the following morning. At 6 a.m., a group of young boys were birdwatching nearby when they saw a man with long blonde hair walking away from the collapsed tent at the bloody campsite. Thinking he was just packing up, the boys went back to birdwatching and didn't either investigate or report anything. 5 hours later, at 11 that morning, a jogger came across the goriest sight he'd ever seen and did report it. Anja and Seppo's dead bodies lay inside the tent, surrounded by a mess of tent fabric that someone had stabbed or slashed through. Melia was found lying dead on the top of the tent, undressed from the waist down. The stab wounds in her body were significantly worse than any of the wounds found on the other two corpses, and medical examiners later determined that many of them had been made after she was already dead. The body of her boyfriend Nils was also found outside the tent. He'd sustained several serious injuries, including a concussion, a fractured jaw, and a deep knife wound to the forehead. But he was still alive when the police arrived on the scene. And he's still alive today. What the hell happened? The keys to the teenagers' motorcycles were gone, but the motorcycles themselves hadn't been taken. Gustafson's shoes were also missing. They were found later roughly half a mile from the tent along with parts of his clothing. When asked to explain what had happened to his shoes or if he knew anything about the motorcycles, Gustafson claimed to have no memory of the attacks except for one detail. He claimed to have seen a pair of bright red and black eyes coming towards the tent from the darkness around them just as the murders began. And then he blacked out. Gustafson's story sounded suspicious to investigators, and he would end up becoming one of three primary suspects in the murders, but not the one the police focused on initially. The first suspect in the murders was Carl Gilstrom, known in the local community as the Kiosk Man because he owned and operated a nearby food stand. Gilstrom was a notoriously ill-tempered, confrontational man known to yell at campers, tear down tents, and even throw rocks at children passing through the area. And once during a drunken conversation with a neighbor, he even confessed to the Lake Bowden murders. So he must have done it, right? Perhaps, but the police didn't charge him with anything, primarily because his wife claimed he had been asleep at home with her at the time of the killings. But then after his death, 9 years later, she would recant this alibi, saying she actually did not know where he had been that night. She said she only gave him the alibi because she was afraid of what he would do to her if he didn't, because he was a violent man and he'd threatened her. Making him look guiltier still, Gilstrom had also been seen filling a well in his front yard just days after the murders. Many people think this is where he might have hidden murder weapons that have never been found. In 1969, Gilstrom drowned himself in Lake Bodum. Guilty conscience, perhaps? Suspicious location. As guilty as he seems at first glance, there is another interesting suspect in the murders. After Gilstrom's wife's testimony took him off the official suspect list, suspicion then turned to another man, Hans Osman. An alleged KGB spy and former Nazi, Osman appeared on the police's radar the morning of June 6, 1960. Shortly after the incident, Osman had come into the Helsinki Surgical Hospital the night before, fingernails black with dirt, his clothes covered in red stains. Hospital staff said that he was acting very nervous, aggressive, just strange. At one point, he even pretended to be unconscious. But after a brief questioning, he seemed to have a solid alibi, and the police didn't pursue him any further. His stained clothes were never taken in for examination, despite the doctor's claims that they were almost certainly stained with blood. Osman even had the long blonde hair the birdwatching boys had mentioned. And he had a history of violence against women, including his wife, Vieno, who divorced him in 1970 and then told police she suspected him in the killings, saying he frequented the area where the bodies were found and that his alibi was not as strong as he had claimed. Another man someone had lied for. Still, he was never charged. Osman was the public's favorite suspect up until 2004, when investigators decided to reopen the case after 44 years, claiming recent advancements in forensic technology and had uncovered new blood evidence found on a pair of shoes, also that they'd recently received a new tip from a woman claiming to have been camping nearby over four decades ago. This new evidence led to the arrest of the lone survivor, Niels Gustafsson. Now police claimed that they had thought he had done it all along. They insisted that they had only waited until there was finally enough evidence to support their claims. According to them, Gustafsson killed his girlfriend Melia in a fit of jealous rage. This was thought to explain the severity of her injuries and the fact that her body had been the only one other than his to be found outside the tent. They believed he had gotten into a scuffle with the other boy, and that was how he'd sustained his facial injuries. He then killed the other two teens in an attempt to dispose of eyewitnesses, then inflicted additional injuries upon himself. At trial, the defense claimed that Gustafsson had no proven motive. At trial, the defense claimed that Gustafsson had no proven motive for the crimes, though. They were all friends, no history of violence. He'd committed no violent acts in the many years since. Also, all four teens had had their jaws broken that night, suggesting they were likely all attacked by the same person with the same weapon. They claimed that if Gustafsson had truly gotten into a fight, he would have been too injured to then viciously murder his friends, let alone walk more than a half-mile round trip to hide his shoes. Despite this defense, the prosecution won out. He was convicted. A new witness said that he had told her at the bar once that he had been the killer. So now we have another person confessing to this crime. Why would he say that? After serving just a single year in prison, a quick successive appeal gave him back his freedom. So who did it? What happened? So many questions still remain. Why didn't the bird watchers, if they could see the destroyed tent, which would have been covered in blood, with two bodies outside it, why didn't they report the crime scene? Also, when new DNA evidence was gathered, why wasn't any DNA taken from the drowned suspect, Carl Gilstrom? Why did two men confess to committing heinous murders if neither one of them actually committed it? And what the hell were those red and black eyes Gustafsson was talking about? Some suspect multiple suspects who all look guilty, combined with the details about those eyes, indicates the occult. Were the teens sacrificed? Was this all part of some disturbing ritual? Did a couple of these suspects work together to commit these crimes? Part of the same cult? If the following claim posted by someone under the name of Leighton is to be believed, perhaps so. Leighton and Amelia had been dating for a little over a year when she asked him to go to Finland with her. They were seniors in college. Amelia said it would be the perfect graduation trip. She had been born in Helsinki, moving to the States with her parents when she was 13. And she still had extended family all over Finland. It might be fun, she said, to stay with family as they made their way across the country. Then they could take a train or a flight to the rest of Europe and do a bigger trip. She still had family there. Of course, we don't have to stay with my family the whole time, Amelia said, squeezing Leighton's arm and staring at him suggestively. I know I really want some alone time, too. Leighton had never even been out of the country. When he first started dating Amelia, which was only 2 months earlier, things had moved along pretty fast. Her being so well-traveled made him feel insecure. She was so worldly, he'd barely been to the next state over. But looking at her smiling face as she recounted stories about camping with her cousins when she was little and riding dog sleds through snowy woods, Leighton couldn't help but feel excited. How fun to have an experienced traveler for his travel guide, someone with family in the area, a sexy someone he was also dating. It seemed like it might be a little bit more of a big step than Leighton was ready for relationship-wise. He still wasn't sure about whether or not he and Amelia would even be together after college. And now here he was about to meet her whole family, but it sounded like it could be a very cool trip. And when would he ever get a chance like this again? So the summer after graduation, Leighton and Amelia got on a flight to Helsinki. The first few days they were set to stay at her cousin Nicholas's flat. Maybe due to the jet lag or all the alcohol they drank, those first few days would turn into a bit of a blur. Nicholas insisted on taking them to his favorite local bars every night, and the days were filled with wandering the city streets, trying new foods, like fish pie, which Leighton actually found himself liking, and trying to soak it all in. If it was a little stressful being around Amelia all the time, if Leighton was privately wondering if they were going to break up when they got back from their trip, he tried not to let it show. And Amelia didn't seem to have any idea. She loved being back in the country she'd spent much of her childhood in. So, Nicholas said on their third night, when they were all sprawled on the couch in his apartment, exhausted from a day of walking around, what's the plan from here? Amelia gave Nicholas a grin. I was thinking of taking him camping, she said. Get him away from the family for a while, out to Lake Bodum maybe. Leighton blushed as Nicholas gave him a knowing look. I have some camping things in the basement storage room you can bring. You two lovebirds will have fun. Don't call me if you get too scared and have to come home, though. Amelia groaned. Something pinged in Leighton's mind. Scared of what? Later that night, as Nicholas drifted off to sleep in the guest bedroom, he felt Amelia get off the bed and go down the hall. He thought she was just going to the bathroom, but then a few minutes later, he heard hushed voices, Amelia's and Nicholas's. Why would you mention us getting scared? Amelia could be heard saying. I just figured he must have heard about the murders. It would be weird not to mention it, Nicholas responded. It was stupid. You know how long I've been working on this, said Amelia. What I've had to do, don't ruin this. Then Nicholas started to say, chill, cousin, everything is still okay. All the preparations have been made, everyone will be there, the beast. Just then Leighton's phone started to ring, he forgot to put it on silent, and some friend back home was calling him, not late where they were. And when he went to turn it off, he ended up knocking the phone off the nightstand onto the floor. Now Amelia and Nicholas, who exchanged a few quick words in Finnish, were now done talking, and she was walking back into their room. Amelia asked him if everything was all right, he said yes. And then he asked her what she and Nicholas had been talking about, and she looked uncomfortable. He'd never caught her in a lie before, to his knowledge, but when she said, oh, nothing, he happened to be up and I was just making sure we had everything we needed for tomorrow. He felt certain she was lying. But lying about what? Good or bad? As he thought about that, as he wondered, did he really hear Nicholas say beast? He quickly fell asleep. When morning came, he no longer cared about what Amelia and her cousin may have been talking about. He probably hadn't heard things right anyway. Nicholas's accent was pretty thick, and after grabbing breakfast, he excitedly bounded down the stairs with Amelia to the basement to check out camping equipment. They packed up and set off that afternoon. He felt great overall. He was on a beautiful trip with his loving girlfriend. He'd just graduated from college and the world was his oyster. However, he couldn't quite shake a weird sinking sense of doom. Everyone will be there. The beast. Why does his mind keep floating back to that? Also in the car, he looked up Lake Bodum to see what murders Nicholas had been talking about. So many articles about the murders popped up. As he scanned them, he quickly realized this wasn't just a small local thing. There was even a Wikipedia page dedicated to them. Why hadn't Amelia mentioned that? Wouldn't the most famous story about Lake Bodum, what seemed to be the most famous true crime story in all of Finland, at least have come up conversationally? Hey, he said, when they were almost there, what did Nicholas mean when he said that we would get scared out here? Amelia shrugged, her eyes on the road. Leighton saw, or thought he saw, her hands tighten on the steering wheel. No idea, she said. Maybe he's trying to scare me. Older cousin stuff, you know. Yeah, Leighton responded. The sinking feeling grew worse. Now he felt like it was heavier than a rock, like there was something weighting him down. She clearly knew about the murders. Why wouldn't she admit that, mention them now? They arrived at the campsite around 6. The sun wouldn't set until almost 11 due to the high latitude. That helped Leighton relax a bit. The more hours of sunlight, the better. The lake was beautiful, truly peaceful. But looking at it, it was hard to completely relax. He kept thinking about those murders. He wondered if the campground they were staying at was the same campground where the murders happened. He thought about the red and black eyes mentioned in a few articles and shivered. He asked Amelia if they were staying in the infamous spot, and she laughed him off. Not her normal laugh, though, abrupt, forced. Again, he thought she was lying. But why? After they set up the tent and goofed around by the lake a bit, skipping rocks into the water, having a few drinks, they went into the tent and started to fool around. Amelia was gorgeous. And the sex was always incredible. And this night, she was really into it, a little louder than usual. He hoped no one was around. Actually, it felt so good, he didn't really care. But now, in the midst of sex, he started to hear it. A soft beat. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. He tried to ignore it at first. Amelia's sex sounds grew louder, and he thought maybe she'd drown it out. But then he heard it again. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. A little louder, like whatever was making the noise was getting closer. Do you hear that, he says? He asked. She put a finger to his lips. Stop talking and fuck. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. That, he yelled. It was a drum, rhythmic, solemn. Probably just some teenagers having a party, Amelia said as Leighton now stopped moving. Boom, boom, boom. I'm going to go look. No, she said, grabbing his arms and wrapping her legs around him tightly. Stay here with me. Forget about it. Boom, boom, boom. Amelia, he said, what are you doing? Just let me go. Look. He demanded as she squeezed him tighter still. He now pushed himself away from her and began to throw his clothes on. What's gotten into you? I just need to look, he asked as she stared at him wild-eyed. Everyone will be here. The beast. Nicholas's words again flew into his head. They're just messing around, having a little fun, she said. What? Leighton asked as he finished getting dressed. Who? How would you know who they are? Leighton now poked his head outside of the tent, looked around in the darkness, and waited for his eyes to adjust. Boom, boom, boom. Leighton gasped. Moving along the shore in their direction was a procession of 6 or maybe 7 people. It was dark, and the person in the front was carrying a drum and banging on it. All the people wore hoods over their faces. Amelia, he said, turning back to her, there are people out there coming towards us. People with hoods. I know, she said calmly. Sorry, Leighton. I really do have feelings for you, but it has to be fed. Fed? Leighton didn't like the way that sounded at all. The beast, he mumbled as he put on his clothes and his shoes and jacket. He looked back out the tent. Now there was the lead hooded figure facing directly towards him. And while he couldn't see his face, he could see his eyes, red eyes, maybe even red and black. Just like he'd read about in those articles about the murders. Leighton began to freak the fuck out. He tried to scramble out of the tent, but Amelia grabbed him from behind and screamed something in Finnish while trying to hold him inside. The drummer's beating quickened as the figure started to run now towards their tent. Boom, 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 boom. Get off! Leighton groaned, and he climbed out of the tent with Amelia on his back. He swung her around, flinging her off of him, and started to run. Boom, 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 boom. As he ran past Amelia's car, he looked back and swore he could see several sets of red eyes now. Red eyes with black centers, maybe? He ran back down the road towards town, ducking off into the forest where he saw headlights. He would end up running all through the night, luckily in his jacket pockets were his passport, wallet, and phone. He was getting the hell out of Finland. He ran until he found a late-night pizza place and hid until it closed. He ignored numerous calls and texts from Amelia. He was terrified the whole time that a group of people with red eyes would approach. Next, he found a McDonald's, stayed there for another hour or so before heading to the airport. More missed calls, missed texts. After taking a taxi to the airport, he bought a last-minute flight back to the States on his credit card. He'd leave the rest of his luggage, basically all of his favorite clothes, his laptop, and more, all behind. There was no way he was going to risk running into Amelia again. He didn't want her to know where he was. He wasn't even going to provide a new address for her to send anything to. Luckily, he'd never told her where his parents lived. For the next few months, she occasionally continued to text him, tried to call a few times as well. And then finally, about a year after he ran away that night, he received one creepy final text. "I'm staying in Helsinki again, Leighton. I've moved back here permanently. So sad I never got to say goodbye and that you won't answer my calls or return my texts. Let me know if you ever head over this way. I'd love to finish our camping trip."
That's it?
That's it.
I hate when you do that. That's just the end.
That's the end.
That's not a real ending.
That's a real ending. Yeah. You have to wonder if, you know, she's out there sacrificing more people or who knows doing what.
She's probably not even there. I feel like that's a lie. That was probably to, like, get him to drop his guard. And then be like, oh, great, she's done looking for me.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. She tricky.
She tricky.
She tricky.
Couple pictures before we talk. Picture of Lake Bodum here, this first one. Yeah, just a nice little tranquil kind of mountainous lake. I mean, I don't know if it is in the mountains, but with the pine trees and stuff, it feels like mountains aren't too far away.
Yeah, it's really pretty.
And then this is an old picture from 1960 of the shredded tent and the crime scene.
Oh, man.
They actually have that, not in the museum, I wouldn't say, but like they kept that, I guess, as evidence, you know, for years and years. And with the new trial, they actually like set it up. And yeah, it's crazy looking. Bless you.
Excuse me. Sorry.
And then this is Nils Gustafsson at the murder trial 44 years after the crimes occurred.
Can you even imagine?
No.
44 years later, they're like, and we're going to drag you here and you're going to lose a year of your life.
Mm-hmm. And then get, yeah, released again.
And then like, just kidding, you're free. But you'd always be worried that you could get pulled back in.
Yeah. I don't know if Finland has double jeopardy or not.
Yeah.
I don't know what their laws are that way. And then this last one, random pic of a hooded figure just with red eyes, just what I imagined that he might have seen by the lake.
Ugh.
If he's telling the truth. But yeah, like just a wild story. I mean, obviously the first part of the story is not disputed.
Absolutely.
The actual crime stuff. And just a weird, mysterious murder. What's super weird about this murder mystery to me is that a couple people confessed, according to other people, about committing this crime. You know, like the cranky guy that had the little kiosk nearby would sell stuff. Like he told a neighbor that he did it. Actually, I think, just two people. And then Nils, apparently like one night, years afterwards, and basically it sounded like a hotel bar.
Uh-huh.
He drunkenly confessed to some random lady. It's like, well, why would he do that if he was innocent? And then that guy, if I didn't make it really clear in the story, that guy who was the former Nazi, rumored to be KGB. You know, it was when he came into that hospital covered in what looked like blood, that was, early in the morning after the attacks. Like it timed out perfectly.
Right.
Like if he would have attacked them at those tents and then went to the hospital later that night, early the next morning, that would have been when he, that's the timing there.
I can't believe they didn't keep his clothing for testing.
Yeah, it does sound, there's a lot of like critical sites or articles out there about the Finnish police. I don't know what protocol was in 1960.
Not good.
And I don't think there were a lot of these. I think the violent crime rate was very, very low.
I bet it still is.
And yeah, probably still is. And it seems to me, not to be stereotypical, but like kind of like small town, bumbling kind of cops who like, they're not used to violent crime. It's like they might have like a domestic disturbance call they have to respond to sometimes, but nothing like this.
No, they just didn't know what to do.
Yep, just didn't know what to do. It sounds like a lot of mistakes were made.
Which is really unfortunate for the victims' families. Because not having those answers is so unsettling. You don't ever get that sense of closure or any sort of peace around it. It sounds like an awful murder.
And the red eyes thing is interesting, where that's when it does come from records where right after, the murders happened and they get the one survivor, Nils, when they're asking like, what do you remember? The last thing he remembered was seeing red eyes before all, like in the darkness coming towards him before all the carnage started. That's a weird detail.
That is very specific as well.
Right. I don't feel like that's a common detail. Like if you're guilty and you committed these murders and you're looking for an alibi, historically the demon did it has not been a good alibi. That has not gotten a lot of people out of guilty sentences.
I can't believe that it took them 4 decades to decide that they wanted to prosecute him.
Yeah.
That's a Something about that doesn't sit well with me.
And it was because, and just to make that more clear, it was based on his shoes, what they're able to determine was that the blood of, it was something about the time, like I think it was the blood of the three people who died were on his shoes, but not his blood, which made them think that maybe he had committed the murders. And the shoes were found a ways away, then taken the shoes, dumped them off, then came back, then hurt himself to get bloody, then waited for the police to show up.
How do you break your own jaw?
I know. And the gash, I mean, that last picture of him, I don't know if it shows up super well, but there's a pretty nasty scar across his forehead.
Yeah.
Like, it was a severe gash across his forehead. And that seems like an extreme injury to inflict upon yourself to try to not look as guilty. Like, he could have died from that,
wound. Right, right.
Seems very risky.
Well, and also, if that's the thing, then it's like, well, where is the knife? Mm-hmm. Where's the or the item that he used to do that? And what's the angle? Because the angle of you doing it yourself versus someone else doing it would be very different.
Yeah, and I don't think they had the forensics types, experienced forensic experts to make those determinations when things happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then also what's interesting to me is the sighting of the guy with the long blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
That description wasn't Gustafson. Guy. It didn't fit him. There we go. And so, okay, but that's weird. So there was just some other random dude.
Mm-hmm.
And that description did fit the guy who showed up in the hospital bloody.
Mm-hmm.
And then another super weird thing that I did mention was if these bird watchers, they're going to have binoculars.
But they were kids.
They're kids, but they said they saw it. And it's just weird. Maybe they were afraid of getting in trouble.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, if you saw somebody walking away from that tent, you're going to also be able to see a lot of carnage. You can't see him, I don't think, the way it was all described, and not see the carnage. And then the last thing, too, or another thing, too, was the guy, the cranky guy,
mm-hmm.
that ran the fish pie stand or whatever. Yeah, the kiosk guy nearby. Well, why wouldn't you? Okay, so he drowned in the lake. They didn't say they didn't find his body.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't you get some kind of DNA of his remains? Right, maybe not. Maybe they're too rotten. I don't know.
Well, and then also like this well that he dug.
Yeah, and couldn't you dig into that well? More?
Mm-hmm. I know. There feels like a lot of like,
Yeah.
Meh.
Right.
Yeah. They didn't seem very interested actually in solving the case. If it takes you four decades to bring in Gustafsson, it's like, obviously this is not high on your priority list.
Yeah.
I was working on stories last night, and I'm kind of bummed now because I would have had a story that would have
would have paired well with this one.
It would have been such a nice compliment. I'll tell it next week in episode 118. Is it 17? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 118. About some friends who go. I wouldn't call it camping, but they're just like in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere, and lots of eyes out in the mountains.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
That's always so creepy.
So creepy. Oh God, it's the end of that story. Ooh, I had to put I was like, okay, I'll look at that again tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much.
Ay, ay, ay.
Eat you out.
Okay, well, if you're ready, let's travel from Finland to England, from Helsinki to London.
Let's do it.
Right after today's sponsor break.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We each have an internal battery that gets depleted and charged based on our own interactions with the world. Some of us feel the most recharged after spending time with people we love. Some of us feel absolutely drained after these interactions. I bet a lot of you are like me. You sometimes are drained and you are sometimes invigorated. Sometimes you need total quiet and alone time, while other times you need to spend time out in the world.
Mostly, I am drained by long bouts of interaction with other people, just anyone, even the ones that I love the most. Even if I'm doing something I love, I still find myself feeling socially burnt out. By the time I get home, I need to be alone, be quiet for a little while, so my battery can recharge. It can be hard for me to remember that I do love having social interactions because I know that the price I will pay is sometimes to be exhausted.
While we both have different needs for interaction and different ways of recharging, we both realize that we need to get out into the world. We need time with other people who offer us unique perspectives on the world. Staying home and only being with one another, while enticing, is not necessarily healthy. It leaves us in a very specific echo chamber. Each of us has been working with our BetterHelp therapist, and that has been really helpful for us to understand the other person's needs and to respect their boundaries when they simply need time to recharge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/scaredtodeath today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/scaredtodeath.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, which means you need to sort out your gift situation ASAP, creeps and peepers. The mom figures in your life have stories to tell about how they became who they are today, from hilarious to heartfelt, from silly to spoopy.
This year, give the perfect gift for Mother's Day, a gift that will capture all of the memories of the moms in your life forever. Give her Storyworth. Each week for an entire year, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question. When the questions are complete, Storyworth compiles the answers and creates a stunning storybook that you can cherish for all time.
My brother is going to be so irritated with me. I actually bought my mom Storyworth last year, and the end result was so incredible. And then as I was reading my mom's story, I found myself jotting down new questions that I wanted to ask of her. So this year, I'm going to gift it to her again. Because here's the thing. At the end of the day, we are always wishing we could have asked our loved ones just one more question. So why not ask them now? I'm really pumped for this second round of Storyworth with my mom. I know I will never regret reading her stories.
Give all of the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you'll all cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/scared. That's storyworth.com/scared to save $10 on your first purchase.
Taco Tuesday, Meatless Monday, breakfast for dinner. Whatever you crave and whatever you need to get you through the week, Factor has you covered. With their never-frozen, chef-curated, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals, you can skip the store, skip the prep, and simply enjoy a delicious meal.
Spring is here, and I bet some of you are realizing you have a lot to accomplish. Spring cleaning around the house, spring break fun with your kids, or maybe you're training for your first race this spring. Whatever it is that you need to get done, Factor has the meals to fuel you through your days. I've been really dedicated to my workouts this year, but before I head to the gym at 6 a.m., I need a little fuel. I chug a Factor protein shake, and off I go. I'm loving the cinnamon horchata and the chocolate banana flavors right now.
While Dan is working out, I'm still rehabbing my old lady hips, which means I'm not working out at all. I have been super conscious about what I've been putting into my body to aid its recovery. Factor has been a huge help to me. I'm currently obsessed with their cold-pressed juice variety pack, which is loaded with vitamins, minerals, and anti-inflammatory properties to support my recovery.
Head to factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 and use code scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code scaredtodeath50 at factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 for 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Thanks for listening to our sponsor deals, Creeps and Peepers. And now for the second story.
Okay.
I love London.
Me too.
Yeah, so this is a cool setting here for this story.
We should go there together.
Yes. It's such a, just it's so great. Much history. Mm-hmm. So much history in the city. And I mean, like the classic haunted house look does kind of, well, it does come from England.
Yeah.
That Victorian look. Mm-hmm. And there's so much Victorian architecture in London. I mean, it just has the feel of like, ooh, there's a lot of ghosts here.
Yeah. We need to go to Manchester.
I've never been.
It's so great. So great. I love it at Christmas.
50 Berkeley Square is a beautiful big townhouse in Mayfair, London, an affluent area of the West End near the eastern edge of Hyde Park. One of the most expensive real estate districts in the world, actually. Yet no one lives at 50 Berkeley Square. It's currently owned and has been for quite some time by Maggs Brothers Limited, well-known sellers of extremely rare and valuable books. And the location not open to the public. Why? Maybe the space is now reserved for dangerous occult literature. They chose to store in a place already haunted. Excuse me. Maybe the owners can't in good conscience sell the home to someone who may try and live there again. If all the stories are true, a lot of former residents have lost their lives in a very disturbing and strange ways at this address. Time now for the tale of the Berkeley Square horror. Built in the early 17th century by architect William Kent, the house has had quite the colorful history. It's had the reputation of being one of, if not the most haunted house in all of London since the late 1700s. The attic especially seems to be the epicenter of an unusual amount of reported activity for one house. The origin of the haunted stories seem to begin in the mid-19th century, at least the ones we know currently, with the suicide of an unnamed young woman, throwing herself from the attic window after years of being abused by an uncle. Rumors quickly spread of her ghost haunting the attic, heard wailing and crying throughout the night, her appearance one of such intense anguish and pain and rage that just the mere sight of her could, according to legend, literally scare one to death. Much more tragedy and horror would follow this alleged death in the attic of 50 Berkeley Square over the ensuing decades. the next reported death, supposedly that of a young boy, who, as an exceptionally cruel punishment, was locked in the attic, receiving food only through a hole in the door.
Jesus.
How long the child remained in that room is not known, but as the story goes, he slowly went mad, and then perhaps tormented by the ghost up there with him. One night that he died, his face frozen in the horror of his last moments. After this, there was said to be a young girl who, after getting on the last nerve of a sadistic servant, was allegedly murdered also in the attic. And ever since, some have claimed to see her ghost in the attic and in the stairway that leads to it. After the death of British statesman George Canning, briefly a prime minister who lived in the house until 1827, the house sat empty for years. Rumors of the large, expensive house being haunted made it hard to move. In 1859, the house was finally sold to a man named Thomas Myers, who soon added to the address's dark legend. Thomas purchased the house for himself and his soon-to-be new wife. However, his fiancée jilted him at the altar, leaving him heartbroken. Thomas moved into the house alone and became a complete recluse. It said he locked himself in the attic, felt drawn to it, and there he suffered a slow descent into complete madness. His family, greatly concerned for his physical and mental well-being, had him removed from the home and placed into a nursing home, where he soon died in 1874. Shortly after he left the home, a nobleman by the name of Lord Littleton stayed in the house for a night under the pretense of some sort of bet with his friends to prove the house wasn't haunted. He, of course, slept in the attic. And he was awoken during the middle of the night by loud noises. As he opened his eyes, he saw a human-like figure, and after shouting a warning, fired his shotgun at it a couple times. He proceeded then to search the whole house, and when he couldn't find a wounded or dead body with him anywhere, he concluded that the house was indeed haunted and that he had shot at a ghost. Soon after this, the house was vacated, and it fell into quite the state of disrepair for a time. An ever-growing list of hauntings made it more unappealing than ever for anyone who may have wanted to purchase it. While it was vacant, neighbors continued to hear signs of a haunting. They claimed to hear noises in the night coming from the attic, including screams. Also, people reported random objects such as books, pennies, and stones flying out of the attic window and onto the street below.
Okay.
All of this led to more curious thrill seekers requesting to stay the night. In 1879, local nobleman Captain Kentfield and one of his maids and a few friends all decided to do just that. Kentfield and his maid were both dead by morning. On arrival, he allegedly instructed the maid to go up and make a bed for him, and just a few minutes later, heard her let out a blood-curdling scream. The other persons present rushed to her aid, found her rolling around on the floor of the attic with a petrified look on her face, pleading, "Don't let it touch me!" And then she just died. Kentfield supposedly still spent the night in the attic, and when he went to bed, the others present retired downstairs. Just a few minutes after being left alone, his friends heard a terrible scream and the sound of a gunshot. When they ran up, he was found dead on the floor, the gun in his hand, but no wound to his body, his face twisted in terror. It seemed as if he had shot at something and then died of fright. Not long after yet another strange death, two adventurous sailors snuck into the home. Chancing to walk through Berkeley Square, they saw the for sale sign outside number 50, broke in to maybe do some ghost hunting, definitely get some free lodging. Settling themselves into the rooms on the top floor right beneath the attic, they were disturbed during the night first by banging noises above them, like doors slamming, then by footsteps that seemed to slither and slide up the stairs and then approach the door of the room the two men were occupying, like something was coming down from the attic to greet them. After a moment, the door handle turned, something shapeless and horrible, its only recognizable visible feature, a wide open mouth, pressed into the room. One of the sailors dodged past the shuddering mass, fled down the stairs, out of the house, deaf to the screams of his terrified companion. Dashing into the arms of a policeman who chanced to be passing, the frightened man blurted out his story. The policeman proceeded to then search the house. The officer saw no sign of any ghost, but he did discover the body of the other sailor, dead in the garden, his neck broken. It appeared he had fallen or been pushed from an upstairs window, and then in addition to his broken neck, his body was impaled on a spiked railing. Yet another victim of the house. Finally, in 1912, a lady named Jessie A. Middleton reported seeing the ghost of a small boy in the house. She believed the apparition to be the ghost of the young boy who had been locked in the attic. She said he still seemed incredibly frightened, appeared to be crying and wringing his hands together. No additional deaths or phenomena have been reported since the house was bought by the Maggs brothers in the late 1930s. Are the ghosts now quiet? Or are the Maggs brothers just not sharing any more of their stories?
Oh, that's it?
That's it.
Oh, I thought that we were going to get some stories, but I guess they're just keeping it all
Mm-hmm.
Under lock?
They're keeping it all. They're keeping it all quiet.
Oh man!
No, since they since they bought it, people aren't allowed in, and so the people who work for the Mags Brothers don't seem to be talking about it.
That's interesting. Did you do any research on the Mags Brothers?
Just interesting antique booksellers. I mean, I did look at their website.
Yeah, I'm just so curious who they are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they sell like, anything from a letter or a postcard written by some, you know, recently dead author or something like that to things that are, you know, first printing of some Dickens book. I mean, they'll sell things that are worth, you know, millions of pounds, you know, like the most rare, the most expensive books. They're a very interesting little business, and they've been around for quite some time.
I'm fascinated by first edition books.
Yeah. Like manuscripts. Mm-hmm. I mean, letters of correspondence between like famous authors, and not necessarily just authors, heads of state, whatever.
Yeah.
They just have quite the collection. And I don't even think...
How do you even get those things?
Estate sales, auctions of those things.
Yeah, okay.
And I feel like their website has had some cool details, but I feel like it's the kind of business where if you really wanted to find out like the super crazy shit they have, you'd have to call. They would have to know you have the kind of money to be able to acquire something like that. You have to set up an appointment, go there. I mean, I'm sure there's a whole protocol for being able to get inside that building.
Mm-hmm. It feels like a very like secret club kind of thing. And then I think of like I can't place the movie, but... It's not Harry Potter, I don't think, because that I'm not into that. But there's like a, you know, is it like the clock keeper or something? The timekeeper?
Oh, I mean, I didn't see it, but I know what you're talking about.
Big old library, not library, a bookstore in London with like multiple floors and the ladder that goes back and forth. Yep. You know, like I have such a specific vision. And then like the shopkeeper with the monocle, and it's like a little bit cranky.
Oh man, it does show up, dang it. And now I want to say Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
But this address is actually the setting in a popular video game series.
Oh, interesting.
And the still shots, I didn't include any of them. I think it's one of the Assassin's Creed. Shows the exact scene you're describing, like the big ladder, you're moving across, but it's like at some point in the narrative of one of those games, you get to go inside and, you know, talk to them and stuff. But it has the feel of a place where, like, they don't want you to know what kind of books they have.
I know. Well, I bet they also have things that they shouldn't have.
Possibly.
You know.
Nazi occult kind of things. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
The world of, like, art collectors... And artifact collectors.
It's a very interesting world.
Very interesting. And I always find it fascinating. I think that we forget that there are so many people in the world that are so wealthy that we've never heard of.
Right?
And those are the people that I think are buying those things. Like, you're not hearing about, like, the Kardashians becoming, you know, big collectors of, you know, fine art.
Yeah.
They're not trying to hunt down XYZ. I'm just using them as an example because we all know they have so much money. But it's like, you know, some... You know, person in upstate New York whose parents, you know, it goes back to oil money. Like, you're like the so-and-sos. You're like, I'm sorry, the who? And then you find out they have all this money and then they have all these cool things.
I'm just picturing somebody now, some like fascinating person who has like some secret library.
Oh, so cool.
And then they have like, you know, like supposedly dangerous or whatever, but like old occult literature and things.
Let's not do that.
Let me, a few pictures.
What a cool way to spend your money if you have a ton of money.
Yeah.
Right? Just so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry.
This is a picture of 50 Berkeley Square at night.
Okay.
And again, you can't, I mean, I don't have any pictures of the interior because they would have been so old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't find anyone, you know, finding them easily, again, because they just don't let people in.
Sure.
This is a picture of the home from across the street, you know, from this little park in the center of the square with that cool statue of, looks like some kind of Greek goddess.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool, just little, And I've never been to this Mayfair, this neighborhood.
Yeah.
But apparently it is very hoity-toity. Like old houses, old money, very expensive.
Yeah, I think the most expensive neighborhood, I don't even know if it felt expensive, was Notting Hill. And I don't know where Notting Hill is in relationship to Hyde Park. But I just remember like we had this incredible dinner at this like little... hole in the wall, but like, you know, it was one of those kinds of places that I feel like only exists in London because I it's the only place I experienced this, where so many times we would be like in a neighborhood walking down the street, and then on the corner was a pub or a really exquisite restaurant that you're like, oh dang, like what's this doing here smashed in between three houses? You know, it's just a different kind of layout.
Yeah.
And I just loved everything about it.
Interesting world with a history where it's like you go into some restaurant and they have like paintings of old aristocrats and things, and then those people actually used to eat there.
Yeah.
And it's a place that like they don't advertise. Mm-hmm. It's like if you know, you know, and their clientele is just like old money, old power.
Yeah.
One more, just a cool sketch of the home. I just thought this was nice and spooky.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that they don't want to let anybody in. They don't want to write any articles. They don't want to...
I don't think they need it.
No, they don't need to. And maybe that's part of the lure of it also, is that it's like, well, you can't come in here. We won't tell you what you have, but you have to be a certain caliber of client to come in here and see what we have.
And that does drive interest.
Of course it does.
You know, absolutely. I mean, because it makes me more interested if I just can't find anything about it. It's like, well, now I want to know more about it.
Well, I want to know who they are. Who are the Maggs brothers?
Right, I'm sure.
Is that actually their name? Is it a group of people? Is it a secret society? What is it?
Well, they've been around a lot. I mean, I'm just pulling this out of my ass a little bit, but I know that they have had that location since the 1930s, and I know they've been around longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the original Maggs brothers, long dead.
Right, but there are their great...
I don't know if it's still in the family, yeah.
Right. Ah, so interesting. Mm-hmm. I love cool stuff like that. It's its own kind of... mystery. Yeah. It has its own sort of like spoopy feeling.
I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look it up because I'm going to look up Maggs Brothers while you're getting started.
Well,
now I'm curious too, and I bet people listening are also curious.
They're probably also curious. I'm not going to start because as much as I love you, you're a terrible multitasker. So if I start telling my story, you won't actually be listening and you won't get the details. So
established in 1853, Maggs Brothers Limited is one of the world's largest antiquarian booksellers.
Uh-huh. Oh, it makes me think of you. That's what I'm flashing on.
That is what you're thinking of, yes.
I mean, that's a different kind of bookstore, but yeah. Is anybody watching that show? I love it.
Established by Uriah Maggs, born in 1828. And he looks like a dude. He basically looks like me.
He does.
With all his hair is white, and he's got his suit on.
And he's a little bit rounder.
And he's a little bit, I'm heading that direction currently.
No, you're not.
After several failed business ventures, Maggs took up bookselling, founding Maggs Brothers Limited. He traded first from his own home, later his first bookshop in 1855 in Paddington. Ran a circulating library, hired out newspapers, and then, they just moved to a few more places. Now their main site is... the Paddington site is occupied by a children's hospital. Mm. He retired in 1894, left the business in the hands of his two elder sons, Benjamin and Henry. And it still is. Okay, it's still run by the Maggs family.
Okay, interesting. Well, there you have it.
Yep.
I spent about 1 hour in Paddington.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I remember my girlfriend and I were like, okay, well, we have to go there. Like,
you have to find the bear.
We have to find the bear. So we went. We took the tube.
Did you see him wandering around with his little raincoat on?
Yes, we did. He's so cute.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, we bought him a beer.
He talked to you. He's friendly.
Mm-hmm, he's super friendly. First, remember, we went. We took the tube. We took a picture in front of the, the stupid sign, popped off, had fish and chips, got back on, and we were like right back into town.
Check did it.
Exactly. Yep. I was like, I don't know why anyone else is going there. I have no idea. Well, now maybe for that. Yeah. It sounds like there's maybe a good hospital there, but I didn't know that, nor did I care.
I do love that checklist kind of thing where I remember doing that. I had one trip in... I was in college. I had like a week in Europe, and I had this Eurorail pass I'd bought like 6 months before. And I mean, I'd saved up, money for this trip like that for like a year and had a very limited budget. It was like I had my backpack on. I would sleep. I did it so economically looking back. I didn't get any hotels.
Uh-huh.
I would just sleep going to the next place. I would just sleep in the train going to the next place and wake up in the next spot. And I would just eat almost only baguettes and blocks of cheese.
Uh-huh.
And then just, water, whatever. And I remember I was in Paris and I only had like a couple hours with my itinerary to be there. And just, I wanted to do the Eiffel Tower.
Mm-hmm.
So by myself, I just took the little metro over there, got out, hoofed it to the top. Pre-digital camera had one of those, like where you wind the disposable cameras, click, click, click. And then selfie, and then huffed it back down. Like it was the quickest, like, okay, I made it to the top. I'm going to take a picture that's proof that I'm here, and I'm going to get the hell out.
Funny.
Just to say I did it.
He did it. Yeah, I haven't actually explored Paris that much. And I would love to go. One of my oldest friends, Rosa, was born and raised in Paris, and I would love to go with her because she has such a different understanding of the city.
Yeah.
I only spent some time in the south of France where I ate a lot of pâté, and now I cannot stand it.
It's like liver, goose liver, or duck liver, or something.
It's so gross. It's so gross. And I remember at the time, like, the people that I was with, we were with this group of like 20 people. And they were just feeding it to me. And I was like, this is so good. What is this? And no one would tell me. And then when they told me.
Is it liver?
I think so. I think it's like a paste of liver, you know, like tomato paste. But and now I've like tried to order it. No, it wasn't pâté. It was foie gras.
That is the liver, the fat, the goose liver fat or whatever.
And I ate so much of it and I loved it on crackers and I went to town and turns out I hate it. But I mean, I loved it then. It's funny how you can immerse yourself in an experience so deeply that that thing is only good in that moment.
Well, I could be your tour guide there because I mean, I spent hours there. Old native like me, we actually say Paris.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. We don't call it Paris, you know, when you've been there a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, are you ready to come back to the States?
I am.
Okay.
Oui, oui.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Do you have anything else? Do you need to talk about, like, baguettes or...
I don't.
Okay, I didn't know if you were going
to
let out.
I am fighting the urge to be like, wah, 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 wah.
There you go.
Just to get some stereotypical bad French stereotype accent out.
Do you feel better now?
I do, actually.
Okay, what kind of squishy squish do you have this week?
Layla.
Oh, Layla. I got an email from somebody that was like, seriously, though, where do you get those? I was like, they just come to us.
I don't know.
I think it's an Amazon thing, but I don't know.
Maybe they come from hell.
Maybe.
Maybe they're devil squishies.
Ooh, nice. Very nice. Okay, well... Diving into my side of the story, this haunted house, it's not even that it was like the scariest of stories, but I just thought about this idea of like living in a haunted house and like how it would feel and then like constant confirmation. And, you know, like there are these moments that we've talked about on the show where it's like, okay, that feels very real. That feels very plausible. And we haven't had a story like that in a while where we're just kind of trying to back up all these various sort of claims.
Yes.
So I don't know. I was thinking about like what stories give me the most pause of like, okay, yeah, that feels viable, you know? And I don't know. Do you have any like off the top of your head, like what would give you either a story that you read or something that you'd experience yourself that would really make you feel like, okay, that feels pretty fucking real to me.
I mean, stories, it's so hard. It's like you just kind of like know it when you come across it. It's not any one kind of story.
Okay.
It's just the way it's kind of told. You know, multiple witnesses always makes me feel like a little more inclined to believe it. But also, I'm just trusting this person says there's multiple witnesses. It's not like I'm going to interview any of the people who tell these stories.
Right.
So I don't actually know that there was multiple witnesses.
True.
It's all a big trust game.
Yeah.
And then for like the experience, I mean... I think part of it would be feeling, but I mean, and again, I think about my lame little mini encounter at the Rainbow Room that I talked about a few times on the show, but I would want, as scary as it would be, I would want something more intense where there's like, okay, let's say you feel the cold spot and you see something that you just can't reason away, you know, like you see something kind of like move across the room, like an ashtray comes up off the table, goes across the room, slams into the wall, no one's near it, and you see a shadow figure, then like
walk. You need both?
I'm just saying ideally, if I saw a combination of things where I'm like, the odds of me visually hallucinating, the odds of this thing, of not being able to explain how this thing's broken. Okay, let's say you just see the visual. I could then try to reason it away later and be like, yeah, well, I had something what happened to my brain that made me just like think I saw something. And the same with the cold spot. Okay, something happened and I just manufactured it. I imagined it. But then if somebody like were to come in the room and I'm nowhere near where this ashtray was and it's now in pieces across the room, like for an encounter where I'm by myself, that would be, okay, that's irrefutable now. Even better than that, I guess, in a perfect situation, everything happens that I just described and there's somebody else, maybe two other people, let's say, at least in the room with me. If I saw something with multiple people, there's physical evidence of something being broken, we all saw something impossible happen, then undoubtable.
Okay. Well, it's interesting like how different you and I feel about things because obviously I spend a lot of time with my crystals.
Right, yeah.
And I waver sometimes where I'm like, am I making this up? Am I imagining this? Or am I opening myself up to the possibility? And is that why this is happening? But I recently went on a girls' trip with a couple of my girlfriends, and there was a lot of crystal, pendulum, tarot card. And it did, there were quite a few things that happened that I was like, okie dokie, feeling pretty confident in this.
Okay.
But they were both there, and they're both more open to it. And like, there wasn't a skeptic in the room. I guess what would have been interesting in that moment would be to have someone like you.
Like, if I were to show up, would I kill the vibe?
Well, what, could you just sit and watch and observe without judgment and just say like, oh no, like, I see what's happening here. They're just, you know, egging each other on, and that they're not seeing what they think they see because I'm sitting here and I don't see it.
Yeah.
Although spirits can show up to one person and not the other, right? I mean, it's not like everybody sees the same thing.
Yeah, according to all this, the totality of the stories we've looked at, that for sure seems like a possibility.
Yeah. Well, this story, there's like some details that really tie in at the end, and I think it makes it so interesting how it ties together. I love when the beginning finds its way to the end, and you're like, oh, okay.
You do like a neat ending.
I do like things tied up, bow on top.
You done. Do.
I do. I really, really, really do. All right, so we have this great story coming from our fan, Anna. She says, Dan and Lindsay, the house I grew up in was haunted. I don't know any other way to say it other than to just say it. My whole life, I would see a little blonde girl sitting on the corner of my parents' bed. The way the house was set up, I would see her out of the corner of my eye as I would walk into my bedroom, but if I ever got the balls to actually look into their room, I wouldn't see her. So I'd always assumed it was just a trick of the light because that corner of the bed was right next to their window. Yes, I stupidly ignored her, the mysteriously opening cabinets, the noises in my closet, the TV that would randomly turn on, and the sense of dread I've often feel in my house, and the items that would move on their own, witnessed by other people. I ignored all of this, but one day I could ignore it no more. It was during one summer during my high school years, and I was at home babysitting my little sister. I was in the living room when she came running into the living room screaming, Anna, Anna, oh my God! I was just walking out of my room and I saw a little blonde girl sitting on mom and dad's bed, staring out the window. I grabbed her and told her we would just grab some of her toys and bring them into the living room and stay there until mom and dad got home, and we did just that. When mom got home, we relayed what had happened. My mom looked confused at first, but that's when I told her that I'd seen this little girl for as long as I could remember. She brought us into my sister's room to prove that everything was okay. And as we were talking, my kitten wandered into my bedroom and almost immediately bolted back down the hall so fast that she was nothing but a gray blur. And that terrified my mother because she said, quote, animals, especially cats, are way more sensitive to spirits than people are. My mother decided to call my aunt, who's very much into the metaphysical, and during the conversation, I heard my mom tell my aunt a story I had never heard. A few years prior, my mother was outside on the front porch when she noticed a neighborhood kid and a friend walk out from our backyard. This neighborhood kid was known to us because he'd had a crush on me in middle school, and I wasn't interested. My mom heard the rumor about him being into darker pastimes, he'd wear very satanic clothing to school, and got concerned that he was retaliating from my rejection a few years earlier. My mom went into the backyard and, after searching for some time, found a pentagram made of rocks. All of the grass inside of the rocks had been burned. My mom quickly said a prayer and rearranged those rocks into a cross. For full disclosure, I don't think that pentagram caused anything because I saw the girl long before they did this. However, I think in those boys' ignorance, they may have accidentally stirred up things they had no knowledge of. My aunt agreed to come over the next night to cleanse the house. That night was a night I'll never forget. I couldn't sleep due to the overpowering dread I felt in my room, but I did finally manage to roll over on my side, my back facing my closet, and fall asleep. I was awoken at some point when I felt small hands run their fingers through my hair. I immediately turned over on my back and tried to scream, but I couldn't. I laid there for what felt like an eternity while I tried to scream until the sound finally came out. My dad ran into my room while I cried. He woke up my sister and brought her into my room to sleep with me. She immediately fell back asleep on my bed, but I was wide awake. I eventually started to drift off. And as soon as I did, the foot of my mattress, dropped down. My sister and I sat up at the same time, both screaming. Both of my parents came running into my room and told the both of us to sleep in bed with them. And the four of us crawled into my parents' bed to sleep. I had a dream that night that didn't feel like a dream. It was almost like I was watching a movie. In my dream, I saw the little blonde girl. Remember, at this point, we're all in my parents' room where I always saw the girl. The little girl was in one of those pre-Civil War one-room schoolhouses and was standing up on her desk with her hands on her hip, telling off a teacher for something, though I couldn't actually hear what she was saying. The teacher told the little girl to sit in the corner and put on the dunce cap, which the girl obliged and went and sat in the corner. I noticed that the corner she sat in was next to a window, and in this dream, the girl was looking out of the window, just like she always had when I would see her in my parents' room. The next evening, my aunt came over. After walking all through my house, she proclaimed that the closet in my room was some kind of portal, which made sense because I'd always heard noises from there. My aunt sat on my bed and began talking to the spirits, and she relayed to us part of the conversations we couldn't hear. Apparently, there were multiple children haunting our house. My aunt asked them why they were there, and they said it was because that they liked the house, and they especially liked my room. My aunt said that she asked them to leave, and they refused. My aunt said that if they wouldn't leave willingly, she would have to force them to leave. According to my aunt, they began to loudly protest and kiss her on the cheek to convince her to let them stay. My aunt lit two sticks of sage, gave one to my mother, and the two of them carried the sage and crucifixes through our house, repeating a banishment prayer and the Lord's Prayer. My aunt yelled at me to open the front door to allow them to leave, and as I did so, she and my mom ushered the little children towards the door. My aunt successfully made it out the door, but as my mother was approaching the door, she completely froze. Her whole body seized up, but her eyes darted from side to side. She looked absolutely terrified. I was screaming at her, but it was like she couldn't hear me. She remained that way for a few moments, but finally somehow broke free and ran out the door to the middle of the front yard. She would tell us later that one of the children had wrapped themselves completely around her and wouldn't let her go. They kept whispering in her ear, "Don't make me leave. I don't want to leave."
Oh my God.
My mother, unable to move or speak, kept repeating the Lord's Prayer until they let her go, and that's when she ran out the door. My aunt declared the house cleansed, but I had my doubts. Within a few days, I saw the little blonde girl again, but as per usual, I didn't say anything. My room seemed quieter, but I still felt dread going in there. 3 years later, I moved out of the house and into my first college apartment at the local, very major university that you may have heard of. We're fairly decent at football, and our team even just made a trip to the White House. Wink, wink. Story over now that I've moved out, right? Not quite. About a year after I moved out, I had to have surgery. My parents wanted me to stay with them after my surgery, and I refused to stay in that house without my boyfriend. My parents, being old-fashioned, wouldn't let us sleep in the same room, and I flat-out refused to sleep in my old bedroom. My boyfriend slept in my old room, and I stayed in my room, in my sister's room with her. The next morning, he came into the bedroom where I was with my sister and my mom, who'd come to check on me. He looked completely freaked out. I asked him what was wrong, and he didn't want to say. I asked him if he saw something, and that's when he shared that he'd woken up in the middle of the night because he felt like someone was watching him. When he opened his eyes, he saw a little brown-haired girl lying in the bed next to him.
Oh my God.
Smiling. He blinked his eyes, thinking he was still half asleep. And when he opened his eyes fully, the little girl was still there and started blinking her own eyes at him, clearly thinking they were playing some kind of game. This happened a few times until the girl finally disappeared and he somehow fell back asleep. After that night, he would never go back to my parents' house. My parents eventually divorced 5 years after that night and moved out of the house. I've since moved all over the country, and on one of my trips back home, my mother and I were in a local Target and saw our old next-door neighbor. We stopped to talk to her, and she told us about the multitude of people who had moved in and out of our old house, none of which stayed longer than a year or so, and all of which had been very local about the happenings in the house. One of the residents had told our neighbor about digging around in the attic and finding an old school book with a pre-Civil War date written in it. I cannot confirm the validity of this book or what they did with the book, but I did find that tidbit fascinating. Love the podcast, and also keep on sucking. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks, Anna.
I love that last detail that, like, because she thought it seemed like an old Civil War schoolhouse, like in her mind's eye, and then to find that book and it, that the schoolhouse or the house was full of children spirits, that gave me such satisfaction of like, okay, you're not crazy.
Yeah. Oh man, that one detail about the boyfriend like waking up to like the little girl laying in bed next to him smiling. Yeek.
What's worse, that or cold little fingers running through your hair?
I thought you were going to say clown next to you in bed, be worse. But the
that is true. oh God, a clown lying next to you with like his big creepy ass grin.
Yeah, that'd be terrible.
This guy right here.
Yeah,
such a violation
just to be in bed with you.
I know.
And then I think the laying bed next to me would be scarier than the little hands running through my hair.
Okay, because maybe like little hands through your hair, I could like, oh, like what are the dogs doing? Or like maybe I'm or dreaming like, or
bug or something, yeah.
Oh yeah, bugs in the bed, sure.
Yeah.
bugs definitely feel like they're running their fingers through my hair.
I was thinking during this story, like a weird thought where like we don't know anything really about this world that we're always telling these stories about.
Yeah.
So much mystery. And I was feeling like bad for the kids. We're like, okay, what if there's this other world out there? We don't know the rules. And then there's a bunch of kids like spirits or whatever, like hanging out in this house, but they're not causing any problems and they're not evil or, you know, malevolent, nothing. And they just like to be there. And then, but then there's other places in their little world on the other side that are bad. And what if when we're like banishing them, we're like doing like a house cleansing and putting out the sage, we're sending these poor little kid spirits off to this fucking horrific place.
Oh no.
Where it's like, that's why they're like, please don't send me out of here. I'll be good. Please leave me alone. And then we banish them. And what if they go to some terrible place?
That's so sad.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was saying about my dresser. Remember?
Oh yeah. That
little kid. I don't know where they're going to go next.
Right.
I'd rather be chilling in my closet than ship them off to somewhere terrible.
Right.
I disagree, but I hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you. I still want to ship them off. It's their problem to deal with. Well, you know. When shit gets hard in my life, nobody's sweeping in to save me. So I feel like, sorry, guys, you got to go.
Sorry, kids.
Well, speaking of clowns, in your worst case scenario, what is like the very worst place that you could encounter a creepy clown apparition? Not like somebody dressed up at a haunted house scares you like, oh, that was so scary. No, like creepy ass thing. What's the most vulnerable, awful place that could happen? Is it sleeping and you wake up and it's next to you?
I'm trying to think of like worst place would probably be I'm out in the road, I'm in a hotel room by myself.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sleeping naked and I roll over in bed and then all of a sudden, pa! Like there's a clown right there laying in bed with me in this room where I'm by myself.
Mm-hmm.
That would be terrible.
Okay.
Another place would be, I think that would be terrible because it's going to be at night. I was going to say the shower. I'm coming out of the shower. I'm putting the shower curtains aside, going to grab a towel. And then there's a clown standing right outside the shower.
Okay, well.
That would be terrible.
Hold on to that thought, my friend.
Ugh.
I'm about to fuck you up.
Yee.
Oh, boy. You are going to freak out. And also, there's crystals in this story. All right, here we go.
Okay.
Hello, lovelies. My sister introduced me to this podcast a while ago, and I've been obsessed ever since. I always listen while working, and all of my coworkers think I'm listening to music. If only they knew the truth. Thanks always for making scary stories fun and my days a bit more enjoyable. Here is my story.
Thank you.
Growing up, I quickly learned the things I saw and experienced were not normal. I spent most of my adolescence coping with the noises I heard, feelings I was overwhelmed with, and the figures I saw. I, of course, did not tell anyone about these occurrences, as I believed my family would think I was crazy. That was until my sister asked my mother about the woman in the house. That's a story for another time. My mother began to tell us about her own supernatural experiences growing up and the reasoning behind her apprehension to Ouija boards and the supernatural. This gave me comfort that I was, in fact, not crazy and was experiencing the supernatural world firsthand. It first began with my closet door opening and closing during the night. I was a child at this time, and obviously I just covered myself in a blanket to protect me from the things in my closet. This escalated to the door opening and closing, the light turning on and off, and small paths through my dirty floors to my bed being made. I never lifted the blanket. It was almost like they noticed me. I unknowingly made it apparent that I could see them or hear them, and that changed everything. One thing you should know is if you notice them, they will notice you. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who lived extremely close to St. Augustine. Due to this, we spent a lot of my childhood in and around the old town. One particular time my family and I had been walking around the fort, we ended up in front of the old schoolhouse. I suddenly felt so cold and so scared. I immediately started crying for seemingly no reason. I looked up, knowing this feeling was emanating from the schoolhouse, and that's when I saw her. It was a woman, if you could call her that, staring directly at me from a woman. A sickening smile crossed her face, and she realized I could see her. She didn't look like she fit, though, her black colonial dress and her gray spindly hair pushed into a low bun. Little did I know how correct I was. When we returned home, I saw her again. She had followed me home. After that, I never felt safe or comfortable in my own home. I had no safe space anywhere. I saw her every day, watching me. Always watching me. It wasn't until I began to see other spirits in the house that I realized something was not quite right. I noticed two children laughing and running through the house. A grown man who stood outside my bedroom door with his arms crossed over his chest and an emotionless stare across his face. A creature-like black figure that would crawl past corners and hover over me. I hit a breaking point when I saw something in the bathroom. I had always gotten a terrible feeling from that side of the house where we shared a bathroom that my sisters and I used. It always seemed dark. The energy made me feel a bit uncomfortable, but never enough to stop me from using the bathroom. Until one night, I got home late from a soccer game and was in desperate need of a shower. I paid no mind to the energy that seemed to have shifted as I jumped into the shower and began my routine. It wasn't until I had relaxed a bit that I really felt it. The energy felt disgusting. It felt like I was prey to a hungry animal. I was suddenly scared to finish washing my hair as it required me to shut my eyes. I was so scared to close my eyes, knowing I wasn't alone. I didn't want to close my eyes as I stood there in the shower, vulnerable. I finally decided, though, to try and rinse my hair as quickly as possible, hoping nothing would happen. As I closed my eyes and stood under the water, I heard an exhale. An exhale that almost sounded like relief, as if it had been waiting for me to close my eyes. As I heard it, I was overcome with dread. Knowing I was done scrubbing the shampoo out of my hair, I hesitated to open my eyes. I didn't want to see it. I wished I didn't have the ability to see things others couldn't. Slowly, I opened my eyes, and what I saw had me frozen with fear. What can loosely be described as a clown stood in front of me with a malicious smile. Its face was melting as if the water was washing away its features, its eyes melting away as it started to wipe away its own face slowly. After I had moved past the fear that had paralyzed me, I ran out of the bathroom, not finishing my routine, not even shutting off the water. I ran outside to the back deck to get out of the house. The house was not safe. Nothing felt safe. I decided to try and protect myself. The only way I could think to get rid of those things was to cleanse the house. I went throughout the house, opening all the doors, pantries, everything, even the attic. I could not let these things hide anywhere. As I opened the front door, the only exterior door that I opened, I lit the sage and began. I repeated out loud and internally, "I cleanse this space of negative energies and those who wish to do me harm." Over and over, I repeated this in each room. I projected my intention, hoping this would increase the ability to cleanse the space. After I finished, I walked outside to dispose of the ash left in the wake of my cleansing. That night, as I was getting ready for bed, I saw them. All of them. We had a door with a huge window in the center, and they were standing outside on the front porch, looking inside, but not entering the house. I would be lying if I said I didn't flip them the bird as I moved past. I maintained cleansing the house every week to my parents' great displeasure. I began to set up crystals in my bedroom to stop negative energies from entering. I even put bells on the entrance ways to also discourage negative energies. I was determined to not allow anything into the house as I was sure I couldn't handle it anymore. Fast forward to my sister and I moving away from home and going to college together. I took my crystal collection as I thought I was the only one affected by the energy in our house. When my sister and I moved into our new apartment together, I went about my routine to cleanse the space and set up my crystals. She asked me what I was doing, as she couldn't feel anything, which made my eyes kind of bug out. She had never mentioned that she felt or saw things in the house. Had she been experiencing all the things I had too? We decided to sit down and exchange stories about experiences in the house. She explained having a bad feeling in the house and having one or two unexplained negative experiences. She then decided to tell me about something that happened to her in the shower. I had never, ever, ever talked about my shower experience to anyone. She sat there and described in perfect detail the melting clown.
What?
We didn't know how to process this information, and to this day, we are freaked out if we bring it up. When visiting home periodically, we noticed the house was slowly becoming more and more negative. We decided to ask our mother why the house seemed to be so active. Her response baffled us. She explained that when she felt energies, she would let them know they were welcome to come home with her. My mother had been, albeit unknowingly, letting anything and everything into that house for years.
God.
It's safe to say my sister and I barely visit, and when we do, we try not to stay in the house.
Oh my God.
Love the podcast and can't get enough of the stories and commentary. Remember, light your sage, set your crystals, and stay safe. M.W.
M.W. I like the ending.
How fucking mad are you at your mom?
That just cracks me. I just never thought of that, where it's like, you know, we've talked about attachments and about, like, you know, somebody bringing an object into their house or something attaches to them and then they bring that into a different place. But I can't recall ever hearing a story about somebody just out in the world being like, come on in.
Yeah, no just, problem.
Choo-choo. The ghost train's heading back to the ghost station. Lots of friends there I've gathered from other places.
Oh, my God.
And like, maybe that's where the clown came from, if the clown's out there. But yeah, and what a great place. I'm taking out my phone again, but only to fact check St. Augustine, because I believe that St. Augustine is actually the oldest town in the United States.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm,
I did not know that.
Yes, yeah, settled by the Spaniards way back in the colonial days. But I think it is the old, I mean, it's a very, very, oh yeah, this is crazy. Guess when it was founded. Just take a guess.
Can you give me a hint?
No, oldest one. I think it is the oldest town. Think the oldest. You know, town settled in the U.S.
Hmm. When did Columbus come? 1776?
No. Columbus came in 1492.
Where? What am I getting? Oh, Hamilton, 1776. I've got,
that's when America was founded.
I've got 1776. I've got the Hamilton soundtrack in my brain.
Yeah.
Okay. 12, 13.
That's way too early. That's way before Columbus. This is 1565. But that's very old.
Well, I don't know. I was like trying to, you were like, just guess. You made me I was like, I don't know. How far back do you want to go?
Right. I mean, that's just, that's so crazy. So if you're just thinking of terms of like, you know, I don't know, the way we talk about like where a ghost can gather.
Set the 1200s.
I love that I just said 1492. And then you're like, okay, so it's going to be older than when Columbus came. Okay, when's the first European settlement in America? Definitely going to be before the first guy from Europe came to the Americas.
I was thinking just like the first time somebody like said like, and this is a place on this giant piece of land. I wasn't even thinking, oh, that's great.
And I don't know.
Okay,
this
now you're
oldest
obsessively
city.
Looking stuff.
Okay. I know. I'm listening though, but I'm just trying to find oldest city in the U.S. Is it St. Augustine? Come on, baby.
Are you correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. Okay. You are a student of history, and I'm
a student of trivia that doesn't matter for most jobs.
Exactly. So, anyways, back to spoopy stories.
Yeah.
How about that melting clown?
I know. The fact that another person saw it.
I know.
Well, clearly her mom, you know, when she's out fucking conducting the ghost train, she brought a clown home.
Choo-choo.
Choo-choo. I mean, if that town has been there for that long, I guarantee you a crazy amount of circuses have come through there over the years. Like since the very beginning of circuses, they were coming through St. Augustine.
Uh-huh.
So apparently one of them died there and she fucking brought him home.
Oh my God. Why is his face melting?
I know.
That's a
Why is he there at all? Why is he in the shower?
Why is he in the shower?
Maybe he used to go in there and wash off his clown makeup.
Ah.
And that's why his face looks like melting. He's getting all the old white makeup. Maybe that's how he died. Because the makeup back then probably had a bunch of lead and mercury and shit in it. And I don't know.
Made him go crazy.
Maybe it made him go crazy. And maybe he killed a bunch of people. And maybe he used to go wash their blood off his clown face in the shower.
Oh. I'm thinking about that really, that season of American Horror Story. Mm-hmm. And it was it Carnival?
Shakes.
Yeah.
I think was his name.
The clown. But what's...
With the cut face. And it was like the crazy smile. Mm-hmm, what season?
Yeah. No, it was like... Because they all have different names.
Or something.
But it wasn't Carnival. That was a different show. Carnival was a HBO show. Yeah. Freak Show. Okay. No, I don't need Google. I have a brain.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Listen.
Boom.
Listen, America's Boom. Oldest town was in the 1200s. Maybe your brain could use Google more.
No, I'd rather learn by doing and getting it wrong, and then it really stays in there.
Okay.
That was like a very Lulu thing. Was it not?
Yes, it was.
We are going to be talking about this for ages. Oh, boy.
That's funny to me.
It is funny.
It was a very Lulu thing to be super confident like, minutes after the 1200 by being like, listen, buddy, I got a brain. That was like you and Monroe.
Oh, my God. 2 + 2 = 5. Mm-hmm. Duh. And God.
But I love that it never puts a chink in the confidence armor.
No. Why? That's okay to be wrong.
Exactly.
Who cares? If there's one thing I've learned from you, it's okay to be wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
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 You're a confident mistake maker. Like, and that's not a dig. That's like, yeah. You know, like if you fuck up, it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I made a mistake. Own it. Move on.
Own it. Move on. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
It was a very much a common theme in our household. Okay. Well,
are we going to do some thank yous?
Yeah.
And the pictures, by the way, if you're a new Creeper Peeper that we refer to in these shows, are available on our Instagram and Facebook. Just Scared to Death Podcast.
Got it. I'll go first.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanking some Annabelles.
I want to thank the following Annabelles. I want to note that I feel like a little burp coming up, so I might have to pause. Oh, boy. I'd like to thank the following Annabelles for their support on Patreon and helping us to donate to the charities that we do. Jose Ramos, Jeremy, Here Come the Spoons, Owens.
Oh, that's nice.
Michael Yagley, Kyle V, Dustin White, Daniel Shipley, Clancy Taylor. Great name, Clancy.
Clancy Taylor sounds like a 19th century prospector.
I fucking love this person.
You hear Clancy Taylor struck gold on the Hutton mine.
Now, to me, it sounds like an author.
Ooh, also.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Clancy Taylor.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Serena P. Abernathy. Great name. William Casanova. Faye Casanova. Hannah Higley. Sherry Jackson. Robert the Dumb Space Lizard. Megan Langley. Jacob Camerand. Sarah Verlinda Alexander. Cheyenne Austin. Sierra Main. Samantha Wynn. Kat Wax. Trent Pearson. Megan Blaney, Kelsey Lee, Haley Lovell, Tyler Haas, Nakia Thompson, and John, no last name.
John, no last name.
John Jacob.
Jingleheimer Schmidt. And I want to thank the following Annabelles also for supporting us here at Scared to Death. Angela Nicole, Ding Mon, lots of A's, they wrote it.
Okay.
Alexis Murphy, David Thomas, Kayla Herringer, Danielle Chavez, the Marx Brothers, but RK, not RX, Chandler Harper, John Gray, Lexi B13, so maybe a military listener with the B13, could be, you know, like I think there's a bomber, I don't know, Missy Jost, when I saw your name at first, I read Moist, Missy Jost.
I was thinking Joist.
Oh, Joist. Danessa Little Axe, very cool, The Author 94, Salome Bonnie, Miguel Flores, or no, I'm sorry, Miguel. I always
Did you
do
say
that.
Miguel?
I know, and it's a habit from long ago. And oh my God, Will XX in San Antonio was making fun of me so hard because he's Hispanic. He's like, dude, Miguel. He's like, why?
He's like, what are you
always
doing?
Always add the
boy.
I corrected myself. John Huggins, Sean Hawkins, Jamie Herzog, Michelle Rush is the greatest band of all time. And now I have Tom Sawyer melodies stuck in my head.
Oh, yes.
Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Duran H., Austin Hemestad?
Hemestad?
What?
Hemestad,
okay. Nicole Dunn, Kate Norton, Athen Holy Polish. Jesus Christ. This name, A-N-D-R-Z-E-J-E-W-S-K-I. So...
Hold on, wait, spell it again?
Holy shit.
Hold on, spell it again.
A-N-D.
A-N-D.
R-Z-E.
R-Z-E.
J-E-W.
J-E-W.
S-K-I.
S-K-I.
Andrzejewski.
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 Hold on, Andrzejewski. Andrzejewski. Andrzejewski.
That's enough. Andrzejewski. And Jared.
I bet it's just Andrewski. I bet it's like, I bet that middle part is just like fucking mushed, silent.
Andrewski.
Andrewski. I mean, I'm Radziminski. It's like you don't hit every.
Yeah. Andrewski. Okay. And Jared Bellis. Woo-wee.
Woo-wee.
Miguel. Fucking nailed it after not nailing it.
Where did you get Miguel?
That's how I've always said it previously.
Why?
I have no idea.
Where did you hear that?
I don't know. Probably nowhere.
Okay.
I probably read it. And I probably said it that way in my head and then assumed that was right for many years. And no one corrected me. So I don't know. There's a long period of me calling Miguel's Miguel's. And no, like years.
That's not even
many,
how it's spelled.
I know. Many years.
And so I, lucky you lived in Riggins. So you never had to ever practice it.
You only had to practice John's,
we had
Adams.
One, we had the Estrada family and none of their first names were Miguel. And they were the, for 2 years of high school and before, they were the only Hispanic people I knew because they were the only ones who lived in town.
Oh.
And it was a small town.
It was a small town. Just a few people.
Just a few people. And then before that, I lived in Las Vegas, which is a big city, but I didn't have many friends.
Well, it's because you were setting shit on fire. No one wanted to be friends with the pyro.
Because I was crazy and I didn't say people's names right. That's our show this week.
Excuse me. I have some spoopy shout outs.
Oh, shit. And I have that written right here and I just ran
over
it.
You sure do. Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to give the following spoopy shout outs, despite Dan not wanting me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
To Bill and Terry from Jennifer and Chase, happy anniversary. To Andrea from Lindsay, oh, happy birthday, Andrea. Andrea, oh, man, this is like a very, like, oh, heartbreaking story. Andrea and Lindsay have been friends for a really, really long time. Like, mm-hmm. I'm talking 15, 20 years. Andrea is really sick, diagnosed with, like, some horrific cancer. Lindsay reached out to me a while ago, and we've just been like, I don't know. There's sometimes just some things that happen where you just connect with somebody, probably because we have awesome names. But we were just going back and forth, and, like, when I read the email, when she asked for the shout-out, I just, like, sat at my computer and sobbed, like, thinking about people who have been in my life that are so significant to me. And it sounds like Andrea, like, met her soulmate later in life, and, like, her life started going how she wanted it to go later, and you just don't get to enjoy it for as long, and now you're faced with this, and it's just like, fuck. Like, you have to seize the day. You mm-hmm. have to. You know, or like I think about like my mom. She met my stepdad so much mm-hmm. later in life and she loves him so much. And she always says, like, I only wish I would have met him sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're just sending you so much love, Andrea. To Michelle from Alyssa, I love you. Happy wedding day. Okay, that's like a nice counter happy thing. Mm-hmm. And Michelle and Alyssa are not obviously, but they are a gay couple and they wrote in one side of the family is not very supportive. So we've just.
Sorry.
Yeah. Fuck it. We're happy for you guys. Love is love. And mm-hmm. you do you.
And now you're building your own family.
Yeah.
So which is the most important one you're going to have.
Mm-hmm. I know. It is crazy how that shifts.
Yep. Don't get to pick your family. If they're great, lucky you. And if they're not, some people fight really hard where it's mm-hmm. like, but I got to have them in my life. I've never been of that opinion. I'm like,
me either.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you don't. You don't have to. There's family members I've cut out in the past and I don't regret it.
Yep.
And they died, and some of them older, and I don't regret, like, oh, I wish I would have made things right. I'm like, nah, they were fucking terrible people.
Yeah.
And I don't miss not spending time with them.
Yeah. And everybody's got their own stuff to go through. But like you said, now, like, you get your own path now. Now mm-hmm. you get to decide what family is and how you get to course correct.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Yeah. To Anna from Bryant, happy belated birthday, and to Nate from Deja. Deja's a longtime supporter. I love you, and I'm so happy I married you.
Aw. That is
now you can close the show out. Okay. My God.
That is our show this week. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else, info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. Thanks to Logan Keith and Liz Hernandez for their work on social media. To Logan again for running badmagicmerch.com. Thanks to Zach Flannery for producing and directing when Joe is out.
Yeah.
Joe is back today. I'll throw to him in a second. Thanks to Joe Paisley for being here today again. Zach Cohen for custom soundbed creation. Heather Rylander for organizing the My Story emails. Thanks to book editor Drew Atana for helping format the listener stories each week. Thanks to producer Sophie Evans for finding today's first story. Sarah Finch for finding the second. Thanks to all the fans for sending in the cool things all the time.
I know.
It's
I love it.
It's crazy that what shows up here. And then... Joe, I did not talk to him before the show. He's back in the office about this. Back in the office this week, appreciates all the messages regarding, you know, thoughts being with him as he deals with a medical emergency in the family with his father. Joe, I don't know if you want to say anything. You don't have to if you don't want to.
I mean, just mostly thank you.
Yeah.
Because they're always there. The listeners of Scared to Death, of Time Suck, of Is We Dumb, just the whole community. It's been a crazy outpouring of just, you know, hundreds of emails and messages. So thank you guys very much.
Thank you for helping Joe.
Yeah, we're also lucky to have such a supportive community where it's like, I know that you worked really hard on Time Suck to make it a non-divisive place. Like, it's a very middle of the road place. Then obviously this show is, you know, Scared to Death is not and doesn't need to be political or like different views. It's like, there's just scary stories. So it's easier to build a community where it was so much harder with Time Suck because the topics can be more polarizing.
And I'm opinionated, which it cracks me up that we've gotten such an accepting community when I can be so aggressive with my opinions.
Well, and then you guys are ridiculous on Is We Dumb, mm-hmm. but like people leave their opinions aside and just mm-hmm. come there for a good time. And I'm just so proud of like how we've built this community. I mean, it started with you, you know, of just people who it's like, they don't care if you're left or right or black or white or gay or straight. It's like,
yeah, they just don't want you to be an asshole.
Right. And like, we're all just people, as mm-hmm. you say, meat sacks, like just trying to get through it. And when something happens, when a tragedy strikes, when a tough moment happens, there is nothing more beautiful than watching people just come together and supportive. And it restores my faith in humanity, which is very often lost. So I am so happy to see our community rally behind Joe.
Me too. And with the community, I was thinking, I had this thought in the shower. It's probably something I'm going to be working on with stand-up, but it was a good perspective shift for me. I think the last couple of years, there's been a tendency with all the divisiveness and anger mm-hmm. in society to see somebody, okay, let's say you're on the left and you see a flag on the back of somebody's truck or you see a Trump bumper sticker, mm-hmm. and then you want to build a whole narrative about this person based on this one thing. Mm-hmm. When really, maybe that person, they just love a few good things about, they love the military, they love law enforcement, they have law enforcement relatives, maybe they are, and they could be very pro your viewpoints in so many other ways, mm-hmm. and they're actually a really good person. Because when I talk to people on both sides, when I talk to individuals, they're good people over mm-hmm. and over and over again. Or maybe you're on the right and you see somebody with the Bernie and you, mm-hmm. They want to turn this country into a communist nightmare. No, they probably don't. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want health care for their kids because maybe their kid has an illness. Maybe they want higher education to be paid for their kids because they can't afford to send them.
There's always a reason why people believe what they believe.
And it could be a very positive thing mm-hmm. that you also believe, but I think there's a tendency to just focus on the negative. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I'm going to focus on building a negative, made-up character mm-hmm. around this one bumper sticker or this one thing. And I just find that when you talk to people mm-hmm. and when people on the left talk to people on the right and vice versa and people in the middle talk to everybody else, I think they find that there's more in common and that they're better people than they assumed they were.
Yeah.
That yelling back and forth mm-hmm. is usually just based on media echo chambers and different and not on actual real life discussions with people. I think.
I agree. It's sort of like that age-old saying, like, don't judge a book by its cover. Mm-hmm. If people judged me by one thing that I did in my life, I could go through a multitude of things that I've done that have not been, they're not flattering.
Right.
Right? And if you, like the time that I stole money from my neighbor, like, if you found that out about me and you judged me on that for, like, robbing the mm-hmm. neighbor's piggy bank, you would think I'm a fucking horrible person. Right. As opposed to, like, knowing the whole story of, like, we could barely keep food on the table, the lights were barely mm-hmm. on, like, we were struggling and I was stealing the money so that I could, like, not have to ask my mom for money so that I could hide it from my friends and I could hang. Like, it doesn't make it okay, but there's a reason why I was being an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Again, not okay, not excusable.
Yeah.
Got in a lot of trouble when they found out.
But I think we have a community of people who don't judge each other by their worst moments.
Exactly.
Or by one thing.
Exactly.
You know,
by your worst moments.
Yeah, they're straight, gay, left, right, religious, not religious, mm-hmm. black, white, whatever. And it's like, and everybody gets along, opposites. Which is so nice and refreshing now, especially.
Yeah, yeah. And to watch that community, we've watched the community come together so many times. And I think our Giving Tree is mm-hmm. like the most beautiful example of that. Because at the end of the day, we all, if you celebrate a holiday, and this time of the year is important to you.
Yeah.
We all know that feeling of like, oh God, I don't want to let my kids down.
Yep.
That is a common human theme.
So thanks for being awesome people.
Thanks,
bad
guys.
Magicians.
Enjoy, we love you.
We love you. Yeah. Enjoy your nightmares, creeps, and peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness. And remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but hath no home here within, scared to death.
Bad Magic Productions.
You ever meet someone who seems kind of off? Whether it's a creepy neighbor or random phone number that keeps calling you, Truthfinder has you covered. You can search for people by name, address, phone number, email, and more. Truthfinder can be especially helpful for running confidential background checks on anyone you're planning to meet from online dating apps. Go to truthfinder.com/podcasts for a special offer. That's truthfinder.com/podcasts to access your special offer today.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.